This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Uma Pagan, Ambika Pagan. And we have a day-long set of things for you coming. We're starting at 6, and I really end late in the evening. But the morning run runs from 6 to 10 in the morning. It's a morning that might find you caught in scattered thunderstorms, apparently, according to the Met Department. Somewhere between 24 and 31 degrees is what the temperature.
24 is kind of chilly.
It is, but I think it's this early part of the morning that we have the 24. So, yeah, don't expect Mediterranean climes for the rest of the day. It gets decidedly tropical around
very, very quickly. Yes.
Now, right now. Now, also, a quick look around the globe, because as we slept, North Korea conducted another missile test.
Twice in a week.
Yeah, and this one is a slightly different missile, Uma, one that is a medium-range missile, different from the long-range missiles that they tested. Not all their tests have been successful, but it is quite worrying considering that the UN Security Council, in fact, censured North Korea and so told them to stop and desist, but they have continued.
But this happens around the same time almost every year, and it's almost Kim Jong-un's quest for relevance. They kind of wants to make noise and go, "We're here, look at me."
Yeah, you know, but unfortunately, he might drag us down a very dangerous rabbit hole. Now, the rest of the morning includes live calls to Elinor Noor, Director of Foreign Policy and Security Studies at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies. And we look at ASEAN issues. Also, we are going to be speaking to Lee Chien Chung, PKR Youth Chief, and Wan Sai Fo Wan Jan, Chief Executive of Institute of Democracy and Economic Affairs, coming out of the weekend and the PKR Congress.
Right. I'm particularly excited about your breakfast grill this morning.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
We have Bao Shanting. He's the president of Domino's Pizza, Malaysia and Singapore.
Pizza is very close to my heart, Sharad.
Is it? Oh, do you like it thin crust or thick?
See, I'm an old-fashioned guy. I like my big, fat, thick crust pan pizza.
I don't know if that's old-fashioned. I think that's an innovation. I think the thin crust is how pizzas began. And
No. Old-fashioned in the Malaysian context, right? Because we got our pan pizzas first. As in, that was what was the first kind of home delivery stuff we got.
Oh, really?
So a lot of Malaysians, I think we grew up eating the cake-like pizza.
Well, now that cake crust, the cakey crust is now injected with all kinds of gooey cheese-like substances.
Cheese, meat, everything.
Okay. And also, we round out the morning with Pressing Matters and our guest, P. Gunasegaram. And we talk about the Indian blueprint. And along with him, we have a live call to Dr. Michael Jayakumar, of course, from the Party Socialists. And Guna also gives us 10 ways to fight inflation. All this coming up this morning, but now we have Stray Cats by Stray Cat Strut, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was the Stray Cats.
That's
with
right.
Their Stray
with
Cat
their little strut.
Strut.
That's
yeah,
right.
I'm Uma. No, I'm not. I'm Sharad.
You're not Uma. I'm Uma.
You know, this is kind of the early morning thing.
Past 6 in the morning, you're forgiven.
It's all... Is it really? I don't know. Some people hold these things in their heart. I don't know. Anyway, moving on to young people in particular, at elite universities think about life. And we have an article here from QZ.com, or Quartz, actually, is the online magazine. Do you read Quartz?
Quite often, actually. They have a lot of good op-eds, I find.
So this is a piece, and we're going to tweet this out, about the kind of skewed reality that can do damage to a young person during their school time. And Uma, have you had a chance to glance at this article?
So this one is written by Emma Sapalia, I think that's how you pronounce her name. She's French. She's the science director at Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. And she talks about how... she fell into this similar trap that people at Ivy League universities, especially, you know, great universities that provide fantastic education, but they forget to teach young adults how to live. And essentially, you get caught up in this notion of, I want to be successful. And right now, and this is true even in Malaysia, not just in Ivy League universities, right? When people tell you, oh, you're going to be really successful, that means you're working a 20-hour day, you know, and just putting your whole life into work.
Okay,
work.
But can schools, or are schools in fact equipped to teach those life lessons? Are those life lessons better taught by parents, by loved ones, people who've grown, watched you grow up as a person, perhaps even a figure of, you know, intellectual importance or spiritual importance to you, right? Like a priest or your imam, or, you know, all these other people. Because I can't imagine schools doing anything but setting up a curriculum in which they have a course dedicated to, you know, life affirming or kind of life goals. I mean, how would you actually do it? How would your university
do it? So I don't think she blames the schools for not teaching that lesson, but I think she kind of wants to give advice to freshmen, because you're in that environment where it's just go, success, work. And they're just saying, wait, you have to put that aside for a second, because essentially, you're going to burn the candle at both ends and kill yourself.
But isn't that what the whole thing is? You get in there precisely because you have been burning the candle at both ends. Unless you're a genius and you're kind of like, you know, you can breeze through these things and, you know, score high on your SATs or
but
whatever.
But you're right.
It is.
Most people get there because they've done all the, they've learned piano until grade 12 and like,
because their parents
on the side.
Aspired for them to be, and this is that you're overachieving kids. Not a bad thing. You look at your kid and say, yes. I think, you know, for my experience, Uma, when I meet parents or meet young people, and the moment of recognition that something is wrong is when the kid breaks down, when it's difficult to hold it together, and everybody's shocked, right? I mean, never mind the person who's had the breakdown, but everybody around is like, my God, they were doing so well.
But also this assumption that you're young and you can take it.
That's true.
Right? Because we don't necessarily consider the mental health of a person in his teens, because we think, that brain is very resilient. You know, now's the time to push yourself.
And it's true to some extent. I mean, you know, we don't give enough credit to younger people. I think of my parents, you know, who decided that, you know, all we could cope with, to put it more ungenerously, is English and Malay as a language. And in fact, what they should have done as when we were kids is fill us with more languages.
Yeah.
But, you know, they didn't, because they thought, well, you know, they were trying to manage things. I guess maybe they looked at us in the crib and thought, they don't look too bright, but so let's give them a head start.
No, but Shraddha, do you not think, I mean, I don't think this is a new thing in particular, right? I think we're hearing more about it now in the age of information, but this has always been the case. Even when you were growing up, when I was growing up, there was this sense that if you were on track to go to university, then you to get into that best university, you need to fill your plate.
That's true. So what is Emma Sapala? I think there are enough dots over that name that suggests, I think, something like something, maybe Scandinavian, Norwegian or something.
Yeah,
like. It could be Italian.
Well, she's suggesting that we learn how to accept our limits.
Okay. So that is, but how do you even begin to recognize, how do you, so when you can say that as something to a child,
you
right?
can, but she ends
what
the article by saying, you know, getting a B on a test is not the end of the world. And, you know, I think a lot of Malaysians, Singaporeans, God knows South Koreans could learn that lesson.
Yeah. So putting things in perspective, right? So learning that reversals in life could actually make you stronger. I mean, there are all kinds of cliches that one can trot out, but they're in fact, in some ways, really important to internalize, right? I mean, that, you know, yes, a B is not going to kill you, and certainly not going to kill anybody else. So you can sort of carry on, you know. What other things would you say to a young person at university today?
I would say that at 17, a lot of the time, you don't know what you want to do with your life yet. So whatever decision you make, don't regret it 2 years down the line. It's okay. You can change your mind and you can do something else as well. I mean, it's not the end of the world.
Pearls of wisdom cast before our listeners. Now, after this, we have Killer Queen by Queen, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Queen. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Uma Pagan, Ambika Paket. And we're going to be looking at the question of our minds, Uma. Apparently, we're not hardwired to live in the moment. That's kind of counterintuitive, because when you think about present culture, contemporary culture, it's all about the present. We're, you know, constantly being sort of forgetting our context, not having a sense of history, not having a sense of perspective. We just mentioned about younger people, right?
So yeah.
They fail. It's like the biggest thing on planet Earth. But some neuropsychologists are telling us that we're not, in fact, hardwired for that. We're, in fact, kind of, future-orientated?
Yeah, a little bit. So this is an article in the New York Times. It's very interesting because it starts off by saying that we call ourselves Homo sapiens, the wise man. But the writer says that's more of a boast than a description. And essentially this idea is that we should be called Homo prospectus because we thrive by considering our prospects. And so this idea of the power of prospection is what makes us wise. Looking into the future consciously and unconsciously is apparently a central function of our brain.
Okay, so it's anticipatory, right? So
yes.
The idea, it's like that predictive thing on your phone, right? It sort of anticipates the word that you're going to use.
Exactly.
So, okay, so that means we're constantly looking for the best strategy. We're trying to decide between risk and a much more cautious or conservative approach to what's happening.
You know, and survival.
Yeah,
right?
So should I go to the next valley where there might be more fruit and, you know, game to hunt as opposed to staying here while, you know, the temperatures are dropping?
Well, the idea is that animals learn by habit and repetition. And, of course, you know, if you're a monkey, you're just thinking, where's my next meal going to come from? I need to find my next meal. Meanwhile,
that's not a nice way of referring to the competition.
meanwhile, if you're a human being, you are kind of relying on the whims and fancies of your supermarket manager, right?
Okay, so the question is, you know, when all these... See, I've heard so many different versions of how we're put together, the kinds of nuts and bolts and gears that go, that are hardwired into us. Are you most persuaded by an argument like this? Because the implications are quite considerable, right? It suggests that what does it mean to only be sort of in that mode where you're trying to make calculations about the future as opposed to living the now?
I think that we are almost hardwired to do that unconsciously. It's an unconscious thing, right? So even in those moments when you're being spontaneous, for example, when you wake up one morning and you go, I'm going to do something spontaneous, I think unconsciously you've made these calculations in your brain. Like, okay, like if I punting school, what are the consequences I need to face? Okay, I'm going to risk it and face those consequences and go to the mall and watch a movie instead. I mean, all of these things are happening in your brain already, which is something that I think researchers believe differentiate us from the animal mind.
Okay, well, that's you know, I think animals are really quite complex, though. You know, and there's a brilliant book by Jared Diamond called The Third Chimpanzee.
Yes.
If you want to understand what we make claims for ourselves, I mean, you talk about, you know, that aspirational Homo sapien thing, is that there are a lot of things that we share that we think are, in fact, unique to human beings that we share with other animals, and not just chimpanzees. Chimpanzees, of course, being our closest relatives, you know, genetically speaking. But so Jared Diamond's The Third Chimpanzee, I think, kind of strips away with a lot of the stuff that we put together to make that picture, that portrait of us being unique. But there's maybe there's something left after you do strip away that bit.
But here's the question, though. Do we want spontaneity? Because I think we do. I think what kills us, our interest, as our livelihoods as people, is the routine and boredom, right? And I think that's the case for spontaneity, right? Even though we're unconsciously making all these calculations, maybe one part of that calculation should be a calculation to be spontaneous more often.
But there's also this whole thing about how do we come to, say, make tools or develop things. Our ability to kind of visualize the future. So almost you kind of, before you construct something in reality, you've already constructed it in your mind because you need that mental map in order to achieve those things, right? So the other thing that we call ourselves is Homo Faber, which is tool-making man, right?
Correct.
So the tool-making, I think it's crucial to and this kind of prospectus, is that?
Homo prospectus.
Is really quite important because the ability to map the future, whether it's in design and things, kind of central to the tool-making. That's my favorite theory.
I like that. I like the tool-making man. I think that's a good one.
Okay. In order to kind of get the deeper sense of this, we have, of course, the China Belt and Road Project. We have a little poll about it. So we ask, can this be a win-win for Malaysia? You can join the poll, and that's online already. We're coming up to the news at 6:30, but before that, we have Give a Little Bit by Supertramp, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan with me, Umar Pagan, Ambika Pagan. And we have in our crosshairs an article that was written by Cheryl Hamdan. He's on the exco of UMNO Youth. It was actually a letter, I think, to the Star and published as such. We've used that as a basis for a poll, Uma, this morning.
Yes.
For which almost 27 people have participated. So it's still early, the 24-hour poll. So you still have 23 hours to go on this. But the question
for the 27 of you, good job on being up so early.
Yeah,
in the morning.
Thank you very much. In fact, I'm going to mention Shamin Arifin, who, you know, in response to the question of whether the Belt and Road Initiative by China can be a win-win for Malaysia, she says, China building bridges while Americans selling arms, surely bridges are better. So, you know, that's one considered position. And maybe we'll come back to the results of the poll at the end of this. But what's important to note is Cheryl actually raises some important questions, and he poses it in a way that I think is very subtle in sort of recognizing the issue. So on one hand, he says, well, you know, there's this platitude that's always trotted out, the win-win cooperation sort of expression. But he says there's also something called, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah.
And he asks that we position ourselves in an intelligent way vis-a-vis China's ambitions. That we need to recognize China's ambitions before we can really truly negotiate this. And he points to, and I'm going to quote him here, says, we see a country bent on building both hard and soft powers in a self-reinforcing march to global superpower status. How then does Malaysia go forward?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think there's a concerted agenda in the mainstream media at the moment. Well, if that still means anything. But especially with the New Straits Times and the Star, to have very, pro-China articles or even letters to the editor. Just the other day, about a week ago, letter to the editor in the Star, which with the headline, China's Benevolence Prospers the Region. Right?
Yeah.
And so that seems to be the line of argument that we seem to be pushing. And of course, everyone wants that dream win-win situation, right? About five years ago, our Prime Minister was speaking at the Shangri-La Dialogues in Singapore, which is that big security conference that they have every year. And his speech was a good one in that the Prime Minister said that we should not, Malaysia being a small country, should not adopt a Cold War mentality of picking sides. We can benefit from both America and China, and so we should benefit from both.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it does seem wise, and I think it's a lesson that many small nations have. But the question remains, Uma, how precisely to do that? And in doing so, yes, we want the media to play a kind of critical role, which is to ask the tough questions, to do some basic research about the ground realities rather than focusing on MOUs and aspirational talk.
Correct.
I mean, all that is easy enough. But I do think that the media, to the extent that the media is playing cheerleader on this, the local media, it's not purely them. It's not purely coming from the top. Clearly, the leadership of the country has signaled its preferences. It's also, I think, there's a ground swell. I think there are a lot of Malaysians who are very excited by not just the normalization of our relationship with China, but really this deep connection, because for so many decades, China was maligned as, you know, a red threat and all this. So that really has changed things around. And it does have reverberations for the local Chinese community in particular, but Malaysians in general.
I'm incredibly apprehensive, but then I tend to be about all of these sorts of deals with major superpowers, because every time someone with a lot more money and influence comes into the picture, it's not just about profits, right, and KPIs, and ROIs. It's actually about influence.
Yeah, and that's what's also interesting about Cheryl's piece, because what he does recognize, in fact, is that this is not merely a business proposition for China. He says we must recognize China sees itself differently than it did, say, two decades ago, and its ambitions in the world aren't just about, improving.
They want influence
prospects
in the region.
Own company.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's a question that's going around now about China, about Jack Ma, for example. Why is Malaysia the target. Why not Singapore? Why choose Malaysia, right? And yeah, we have a lot to offer. I have no doubt about that. But at the same time, I'm incredibly cautious because I think our lack of systems, processes, and even rule of law is something that China, being, if there's anyone who can fight us with regards to corruption, it is China, right? I mean, if you go and look at China's corruption index and stuff, it's quite a scary thing. The judicial system, they do not necessarily believe in separation of powers. And it's something that maybe in that sense, they think doing business with Malaysia is easier. And that's concerning.
We're going to be coming back to this. I'm picking up these stories later on, especially on the question of China-Singapore relations, which were really on the high 3 decades ago.
If you think of those times,
taken down recently. And we're going to be speaking to Elena Noor from the Institute of Strategic and International Studies. All that coming up, of course, after the 7:30 bulletin. Now we have, coming up after the ads, Ooh La La by The Faces. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me, Tan Chung Han and Uma Pakin Ambike Pakin. We have, we're coming up to, because the roundup of the kind of news that is going to be driving headlines today and for the rest of the week. But before that, Han, I just want to mention the fact that we have a poll out. And this is based on an article by Charles Hamdan, who, of course, was with the UMNO Youth Exco. And he makes an argument for the for our participation in China's Belt and Road project. And we ask, can this be a win-win for Malaysia? And you can answer yes, no, or you don't know enough. In fact, the majority of people, 53% of those who've voted in this poll, say they don't know enough to make that assessment. 7% say, yes, we can. It can be a win-win for us. We can get the best deal. And 40% say, no, we are weak. So that's our poll for the day. It's going to be running for the next 23 hours. So join in on the BFM Twitter poll. Now, coming back to you, Han, the stories in the mix today, ASEAN first quarter economic results and the unemployment rate.
All right, so after the 7:30 a.m. news bulletin, we're going to go with some headlines that revolve around ASEAN. So we've been given plenty to think about over the weekend. For example, you got Malaysia, Singapore, Vietnam and Brunei among the 11 TPP countries who agreed to go ahead with the trade deal without the U.S.
Now,
this is now this is something that, you know, we've been talking about a lot on this show. Really, how substantial is this? You know, is it even worth it to go ahead with this TPP without the U.S.? You know?
But they're going to have to do some heavy renegotiating of the pact. So we're looking at, what, more years for this to actually unfold?
Yeah, no, certainly. And also, you know, whether or not this TPP without the U.S., whether this is a priority for Malaysia, I think that's going to be a question mark, you know, versus other negotiations or other potential trade deals with other, you know, huge economies of the world. So you've got that. You also got comments from Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, you know, saying that apparently China had threatened war if the Philippines agrees that, if the Philippines drills for oil in the South China Sea. So, no, really, on one hand, you know, when you got comments coming out of Duterte, you
have to take everything with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, you know, in this case, a lot of salt water as well, you know, so seawater. So, whether or not we should really read it as it is, or, you know, perhaps there's some substance to this. Also, you know, perhaps Singapore China relations. We'll get more insights from Elena Noor, who is the Director of Foreign Policy and Security Studies at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies in Malaysia.
Okay, what about those first quarter economic results?
All right, Malaysia's economy grew 5.6% in the first 3 months of this year, fastest growth in 2 years. Look, very often, you know, we tend to talk about the more troubling headlines. And I think, to be fair, you know, here on this show, you know, when there's new, you know, good news coming along, you know, we kind of pass it on. I just try to, you know, liven up the mood on this Monday morning here. So again, to more details on the GDP figures and also unemployment fell. So we'll get more details after the 7:30 a.m. news.
Okay, we're coming up to the news, in fact. But before that, we have I still haven't found what I'm looking for by U2, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.